7 years ago, CNN.com asked me to pen something about the Super Bowl. So I wrote a piece, headline, I hate Super Bowl parties. And basically, it broke down all the reasons I don't enjoy Super Bowl shindigs. I like watching the game in peace, I enjoy focusing on the action, and my biggest thing, I hate know-it-all fans. So I wrote about a recent Super Bowl and a guy at the party named Miles, who, quote, predicted every play 5 seconds before the snap and was right approximately 0.00872% of the time. And even though Miles was a pseudonym, the guy I was referring to read the column and it didn't end well. He blocked me on social media. He ripped me to mutual friends. And he was right. It was a dick move just to be a dick. So don't do that kind of shit. It never pays. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 9 books and the host of Two Writers, Sling and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. Today's episode features Teresa M. Walker, the longtime Associated Press pro football writer who spoke to me from the back of the bus heading back from Super Bowl 54. We discuss her experiences on the big stage and whether covering a Super Bowl is great or kind of sucky. Also a note, this episode was done in 2 parts. The first half was done on the bus after the Super Bowl, and the second half was actually done a week and a half ago before the death of Kobe Bryant. This is episode number 141. Let's sling some yang. All right, Teresa, I truly feel like we're in the middle of a miracle here, a Super Bowl miracle, because I did not think this would work. You've just covered the game. It's a few hours later. Where are you right now?
I'm on a bus waiting for it to leave so we can go back to the hotel and maybe get a couple hours sleep before I do some more radio in the morning and then pack up and head to the airport to come home.
So is covering a Super Bowl fun and glamorous, or is it a pain in the ass and long lines?
It's a mix of the both. I mean, I was in the auxiliary box for this game, and that's part of the seats at the Hard Rock Stadium. So my knees were pressing against the seat in front because they had a table put across it. And to get out, once everyone got in, I had to climb onto the seat and walk along the back, to go get something to drink or something like that. So, but, I got to watch the halftime show, the commercial that the NFL 100 commercial where they had the young man running out onto the field. That was really cool. And this time they actually showed some of the commercials inside the stadium. And I'll say this, if you're going to go to a Super Bowl as a media person, it's much better to be in a stadium where you're part of you're out in the crowd. I was at Super Bowl 50, and let's just say Levi Stadium, that press box is hermetically sealed. So even though I had the earphone the radio broadcast in my ear, I was several beats behind. I never got to enjoy part of the halftime show. So this time I got to watch it all. So that was different and fun.
So how far were you from the field itself where you were sitting?
In the upper deck, section 302, in the end zone with the Chiefs logo in the end zone. So, and I hate press boxes where you're at one end zone and you're looking down the other way. It kind of distorts the field, but, they've got video boards in each of the 4 corners, so it wasn't too bad.
What was your day, soup to nuts? You woke up at what time this morning, and when did you actually go to the stadium?
Woke up at about 8 o'clock, went downstairs and had breakfast at 9. Then did a few things, put some stuff into the system, and then went downstairs at 1 o'clock to catch a 1:30 bus to the stadium. And then once we got to the stadium, I was working on the notebook today and got busy as soon as I got settled into my seat.
I've never covered a Super Bowl, so I have no concept of this. Like, you can't go on the field, correct? Like, you're not going down to the field. Are you stuck in a certain area? And how do you even work on stories from the actual Super Bowl?
Okay. That's a good question. It's a challenge. You can't go down on the field. During the regular season, you can go down before a game. You can shoot videos and tweet them out or whatever on social media of people who are warming up, things like that. You can't do that at the Super Bowl. Why? Because there's just so many people here. So what I did was you can walk around the concourses. So I went and talked to some fans. I talked to a Chiefs fan who actually won a couple of tickets in October that were, a drawing at a 5K walk at Arrowhead. And she had people offering her $10,000 for the tickets in the parking lot. So she decided, no, I'm sticking with these. She was a Chiefs fan and, you know, was living her dream. So went out and talked to people, then went back and started writing. Now, post-game, it's you're very oriented. So they have a post-game interview tent, and, you know, they've got the Chiefs on one side, the Niners on one side, and in the middle they had a podium and some seating for the winning coach, Andy Reid, and the MVP, in this case, Patrick Mahomes. On the other side for the teams, they've got a handful of podiums, and you have to try to, you know, you kind of have to guess because you don't know which podium which player is going to, you know, and so you have TV cameras trying to set up tripods, and that part can get a little crazy. I did try to break away after Patrick Mahomes talk, tried to get to the Niners locker room for Katie Sowers, but let's just put it this way. When you lose a Super Bowl, people tend to clear out quickly.
I know there were like 6,000 credentials issued for the Super Bowl, which is mind-bogglingly insane. Like, after a game, you can go into the locker rooms and actually get people.
Yes. Now, because that's the thing, while they have that interview area and they bring in some of the, you know, like George Kittle and some of those guys, they're not bringing in, you might have media that are wanting, you know, say if you're from Nashville and you wanted to go talk to Justin Skule, who got into the game when Joe Staley went out for at least a series, or you might want to go to the Chiefs locker room to talk to Kyle Shermer, or, you know, so whoever your local guy is, you know, you're not going to get him at that big tent, so you go into the locker room. So you can do that, which is, you know, kind of cool because that is a key part of the regular season.
Right. So do you, as a part of the AP team, do you meet up with all the other AP writers and sort of figure out what you're doing? Is that predetermined ahead of time? How did you even know what you were going to do today?
Oh, absolutely. We kind of had a, you know, now some of the folks have got roles that they've had at several Super Bowls. So Barry Wilmer always writes the main story. You know, there we had a columnist, and, you know, so there's the MVP, there's the key play. So those things are kind of, you know, known. And yeah, we did have a conversation last night, this morning, saying, okay, you're going to do this, this, and this, just to make sure everyone knows their role. But it's a game, so sometimes it can break. If the Niners had won, I would have written, I would have been trying to get Katie Sowers for a whole sidebar just on her becoming the first woman to, you know, help win a Super Bowl.
So what were you writing? How many stories did you end up writing or working on just today?
Just today, I worked on the notebook, but then I also shot and filed two different videos from Patrick Mahomes on Andy Reid, and then Patrick Mahomes on the big play, the third and 15, where he's had the 44-yard pass to Tyreek Hill. So, yes, video I shot on my phone, I edited and filed using some AP photos and video that I shot. So, and then go back in and help embed some video, official NFL video, into some of our stories.
Does it impact the happiness for you of a game based on who you're sitting next to? Like, did you know the people you were sitting next to today? And can that impact good, bad experience?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. The person to my left and right were both AP colleagues. So, you know, I have sat at stadiums for games with people that you really would rather not be sitting next to. I mean, let's face it. Some people talk too much. Some people don't talk at all. You know, personalities are interesting, and some people are a little messier in the press box. I know I tend to do that myself at times, so that can make it challenging.
Ooh, is there yelling going on the bus right now?
Just a little bit. They're trying to get the bus loaded and get it moving out from the stadium.
This is awesome. I feel like I'm there with you on the bus right now. This is very, very interactive episode.
But at least you're not in Eastern time zone. So, you know, by the time I get back to the room, it's going to be close to 3 a.m. Eastern time. Luckily, I have a late afternoon flight, but my checkout from the hotel is at noon.
Oh, my God. Here's a dumb question for you. Maybe not dumb, but so you're one of a gazillion people writing on the Super Bowl. You're literally one of a gazillion people there. Does it matter that you're there? Like, is there anything you can do, Teresa, veteran writer, but you don't cover either of these teams and you're compiling notes for the AP? Like, is there anything you can really get in that ocean of people that makes that big of a difference? I say that with all due respect, and I'm an admirer of your work.
Well, I'll say this. I think so, because everybody brings their own vision, their own viewpoint. You know, we all ask questions differently and we all write differently. So, you know, on the field, people are looking for different things. I mean, there was a woman who was arrested who tried to run onto the field tonight. So, and thankfully one of our photographers caught that, shot it, and we were able to, you know, we saw that and were able to update that. One of my colleagues, not me, but yeah, when you're at a game, you see things that TV just can't show you because TV is showing you what it wants to show you. That's the beauty of being, you know, you're there, you're getting the 360. You can look at whatever you want to.
You told me earlier when we talked before you were bumped after Kobe passed, your plan was to do a profile of Katie Sowers, the, as you mentioned, the 49ers assistant. How did that go during the week?
That went very well. Now, the problem was she was available at media night, and she talked for the entire 60 minutes. The problem was finding her on the floor of Marlins Park. You know, I walked past her at one point and didn't recognize it because there were so many media around her. I mean, she literally talked for all 60 minutes answering questions. And so when I realized that was her, I wormed my way in up to the barrier, and I probably camped there for about 10 minutes until I realized, you know, until I felt I had enough material to be able to write a story about her.
Is it impossible to get original material at the Super Bowl?
It's impossible to get exclusive material at a Super Bowl. So I think you can still get really good stuff. It's, you know, that's where some experience comes into play, having a game plan, knowing what you're looking for, and trying to go in armed with questions and to get what you need to get.
Right. What is media day like? I've never experienced it. Is it the worst or the best?
It's the worst, and it's getting worse. I mean, this time they had a whole baseball field to put people, and they had it kind of sectioned off, and it felt like we were just herded into inside these curtains. So trying to get around, there wasn't as many costumes or craziness in that regard this year, but it was just tougher to move around.
Is it frustrating?
Oh, very, because, you know, you've got people, there was somebody there with a Rock'em Sock'em Robots. There were some people there, a lady who was dressed like in a Navy uniform with a gone fishing game. And, you know, and they're doing these bits to, you know, for whatever their purposes are. And, you know, you're trying to collect what you can and try to get around. And I mean, there was one person who had a frame with, looked like a dummy attached. And when you look at the head, it was an iPad wrapped up in to, you know, it just sometimes there are very bizarre things, and here you are trying to work on stories, notes, videos, and all these things, and you're having to work around these folks. So it's its own unique challenge.
It's interesting because I, like you, I was raised with certain ideals of journalism, and I feel like Media Day, more than any other event in sports media, perhaps, sort of laughs in the face of those ideals.
Yes, because you have so many people there that, you know, that's where the 6,000 people, it seems like that's where some of those folks look for their moment to shine or stand out. And then so many others are just there trying to work.
I'm interested. We texted about this earlier in the week. I really thought Kobe Bryant's death in an amazing way overshadowed the Super Bowl and set the Super Bowl aside to a certain degree. But I wonder if that's just my perspective being here in Southern California, or if you felt that way as well during the week in the lead up.
Oh, no. I mean, completely. It was the talk of the week. I mean, on Monday at media night, you know, there were people still reacting to the news that was, you know, barely, 36 to maybe 40 hours old. Even today on Sunday, the day of the Super Bowl, you had people like Richard Sherman. He read the Dear Basketball poem from Kobe, and that was shared on social media on video, and he came wearing a Kobe jersey. So lots and lots of the players on the field were warming up with, you know, either, you know, Laker colors, Kobe's numbers on their shoes. So it's still continued through to today.
I said to my wife tonight, like you, I grew up watching the Super Bowl and loving the Super Bowl, and I would sit in front of my TV and watch it and just hold a football. And I feel like it's, you may totally disagree, I feel like it's gotten a little too big, where it doesn't feel, it feels like you're eating a lot of sugar, not like you're watching a football game. But maybe that's just me again. Like, do you feel that way? Or are you super happy with the Super Bowl and you're just, it's great and this is the best thing ever?
You have a point there, Jeff. I mean, let's face it. I mean, at a certain point, they're showing all the celebrities that are in the stands, from Kevin Hart to, you know, some people, I think Little Nas X or whatever from Old Town Road was there. I mean, it's become the place to see and be seen inside the stadium, you know, between the commercials and, you know, shoot, the Super Bowl halftime show. And, you know, it's packed. I mean, it's just, it does feel like it's overflowing just a bit. But then when the kickoff comes and you've waited two whole weeks, I do wish we had this game on a Saturday, so that, yeah, I do buy the idea that it'd be nice to have a Sunday to recover and everybody just kind of catch your breath before going back to the next work week. But once it kicks off, and yes, it was a little rough there. You know, Mahomes was incomplete on his first two passes. Then it becomes a game, and you watch somebody do something like Mahomes and the Chiefs, first team in NFL history to, you know, come from 10 or more points down in each game in a single postseason. So, you know, that's the fun part. You know, we see things happen that had never been done before.
Did you get a vote? Were you one of the people? Could you vote for the MVP?
I did not. I was too busy. I don't like to vote for these things because I don't like to, you know, influence how, you know, who's recognized for this or that. I've never had a Heisman vote, and I'm happy with that.
Yeah, that's good. Let me ask you a final thing. The our president Donald Trump tweeted tonight, yeah, congratulations to the Kansas City Chiefs on a great game, a fantastic comeback. You represented the great state of Kansas very well. Is it okay for me to mock him ruthlessly for doing that, or should I hold back a little bit? And it's an honest mistake. Well, you might think the Kansas City Chiefs playing Kansas.
I will say this. I always have to stop and check. Even though I've been to St. Louis, I've never been to to that part of Missouri. I have to stop and check and say, wait a minute, Kansas City, Kansas, Kansas City, Missouri. So that's one I definitely think probably a little dispensation would be okay.
All right, cool. All right, Teresa, listen, thank you so much for jumping on here. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. And I'll just point out, I picked the Chiefs.
You did pick the Chiefs. Nice job. Nice job. Oh, you had a 50-50 shot on that. So you can't get too cocky about it, though.
Oh, come on. I'll take a win whenever I can get it.
Before we continue with Two Riders Singing Yang, a quick word from our sponsor. Hey, this is Jeff Perlman, and I'm here with Grandma Sandy. And on behalf of 503 Sports, kings of the throwback sports merchandise, we take this look back at Super Bowl history.
I went to the DMV last week because I lost my wallet, and I had to wait in line for 45 minutes. And my bunions hurt, so I told the lady, "Ma'am, my bunions hurt. Can this line move faster? I need to be back at the Hamilton House at 3 for Canasta." And she said, "I'm sorry, but there are many people who were here first, so you have to wait." And I told her, "But Marge is bringing brownies to Canasta, and she uses chopped nuts." My, I love chopped nuts, but the lady made me wait, and I missed the nuts. Do you know what time Law & Order is on?
Grandma Sandy, what does any of this have to do with the Super Bowl?
Do you have my sandwich?
I have in front of me a piece by you, and it's your first Super Bowl that you covered was Titans-Rams. It was from the January 31st, 2000. Teresa Walker, AP sports writer. Your lead was 1 yard, 36 measly inches. For a month now, Tennessee had been getting that extra break. On Sunday night, the Titans fell a Tennessee two steps short. "It's ironic, isn't it?" Dyson said. "We're 16 seconds away from not even being here and not even being in this game. It's ironic." How memorable was that experience for you? And what do you remember about covering that game with a team you covered coming that close to winning?
That was amazing because I went from covering a team that in 97, 98, 8-8, played in Memphis in 97, at Vanderbilt in 98. No one cared. You know, forget no one caring in the state of Tennessee. No one cared around the NFL. It's like, you know, Bud Adams moved his team to Nashville. That's nice. Then suddenly they're 13-3. And that Music City Miracle took me on a ride from there. So to Indianapolis, then to Jacksonville. And literally after the AFC Championship game, I rode in a car with AP greats, Dave Goldberg and Hal Bach, to Atlanta. And suddenly, you know, there was no 2 week break that week. So it's 1 week. That was my first real big event. And I felt like I was swimming a little bit. I'd covered the Olympics in 96 in Atlanta, but you know, that was a little different. I was at a venue. I wasn't in the midst of the Olympics. That was just like jumping into the deep end from the top diving board. So and when you're covering your team, you're writing two stories a day, one for the AM cycle, PM cycle, morning and afternoon papers. And, you know, so different topics. There's all these other folks who are also writing about your team. You're answering questions about that. And then suddenly you're in the auxiliary press box there at the old Georgia Dome preparing for a game. It was amazing. And listening to you read that, it's like, okay, maybe I didn't do as badly as I thought I did that week.
I'm actually fascinated by this. Like, so here you are, and it's your team, the team you cover in the Super Bowl, and you've spent this year with the Tennessee Titans. And I'm sure you do your best to build relationships with whatever, Steve McNair and Jeff Fisher and Eddie George and Kevin Dyson, all these guys. And then you get to this stage where it's your team and you're covering your team, and there are a million other people suddenly surrounding you also trying to get stuff. Are you, Teresa, in that situation, gracious and wanting to help everyone? Or are you kind of like a cat with your hair up? Back off. This is my turf.
Like that with other people. AP colleagues different because, you know, they'd have questions. I'd point them to people or, you know, answer a tidbit, a stat, things like that. But the advantage that you have when you're the beat writer and your team is at suddenly that stage, you go up to a player that, you know, they're looking out in the sea of people and it's like, I know you. May not like you back home, but I know you and you're something familiar in this crowd. So, you know, you get a chance to maybe they'll turn to you and answer your question as opposed to somebody that they don't know who's, you know, maybe louder, maybe more insistent, but you get that little home field advantage, so to speak, which is really nice.
So you can't be friends with these guys, obviously, but it is good for them to recognize you and to whatever, know your name and sort of want to confide in you. How do you sort of build that with athletes?
That is the challenge. And for me particularly, because I also cover the Predators, Vanderbilt, Grizzlies. So I have a lot on my plate. But when I'm in the locker room, it's try not to always just be asking them a question for a story. And I help out colleagues on some of their stories where, you know, maybe I won't go to this guy, you know, because I don't need him this week, but he would be good for the story that another person's working on. And I'll go and ask a question and try to just, you know, say, hi, I'm Teresa with the Associated Press, and just being polite and, you know, not just treating them as somebody, I've got a question, answer this and then leave. You know, that's how I do it, at least in the first steps. And then, you know, Logan Ryan, when he first got here, I was wearing my hat from the Super Bowl in Super Bowl 51 in Houston, and it had the score. Matt LaFleur, who's now with the Green Bay Packers, he didn't like that hat when I wore it to talk to him one day last year in 2018. But Logan Ryan, he was on the winning side of that. So, you know, that was something, you know, yes, I wore it that day knowing I was talking to Logan with a purpose to, you know, at least let him know that, well, I was at that game and I worked that game. Logan Ryan's a great example. He's very involved with animal rescues, raising money for, you know, shelters and things like that. And I've made sure to retweet some of his tweets. And, you know, if he's having a fundraiser, shoot some video, tweet that out with his handle. It's not much on my part. It's on my Twitter account. It's not in an AP story that's going out, but it helps give some visibility to what he's doing. And for some of these guys, when they're doing a charity event, I'll retweet what their Twitter account has to help give them a little bit more attention if I can.
Does it matter if they know your name?
No. As long as they give me an answer, that's all I want. Now, I will say this. Last week, Derrick Henry said, yes, ma'am. I didn't see it because I was focused more on his answer to my question. And a couple people told me later, he manned you. And it's like, you know, sign of respect, that's nice, but it's like, oh, just makes me feel old, Jeff. You know that feeling now.
I just want to say one of the great myths. I don't know how this happened. One of the great myths out there is that people want to be called ma'am and sir. It's total bullshit. Do you want anyone to ever call you ma'am?
Not really, but I will say this. The people who've done it to me, and it's mostly athletes, young athletes, and it's, to me, it's mostly athletes who've been raised in the South. So it mm-hmm. does feel like mama raised you right kind of thing. So, right. So I did go up to Derek, the next day and I said, hey, Derek, I appreciate that you're, you know, very well mannered young man, but you just make me feel old when you do that. So, you know, yeah. So I gave him a little heads up that it's like, I appreciate where you're coming from. Your grandma, your late grandmother won't be, you know, I'm giving, please see this as dispensation. Don't call me ma'am again, please.
Was he okay with that?
He smiled. So I think so. But, you know, some mannerisms are just ingrained in us and we can't get away from them.
Do you at all feel that age impacts the way you cover athletes or athletes relate to you? Do you feel like when you were doing this and you were 28, athletes related to you in a different way than you do now in your 50s?
That is a great question. I think so, yes, because particularly when I was young and covering sports, you know, there's a little bit of an intimidation factor, because when I first started doing this in 92, I had covered some events and I'd written tons of basketball and football games. But then you get out there and you're starting to deal with folks, and there was no email, there was no social media. I didn't have anyone I could ask or talk to as a woman for suggestions on how to deal with things. So I just tried to blend in to the pack of guys. And, you know, the old saw of don't ask a really, you know, I'm not afraid to ask a dumb question. We all do, but try to at least have some clue what the answer might be before I ask a question, so I don't look like some, you know, young, stupid kid who doesn't know what they're talking about. And the older I've gotten, the more confident I've gotten, for sure. And I know my basis. So it's like, I don't have problem throwing out any question. I ask it. A bad question really badly these days, but at least I know where I'm coming from, and I have the confidence that I'm not going to, shrivel up again. And nowadays, this is the tough part. Now I've gone from covering people who are close to my age, maybe a little older than me, to now I'm covering athletes who are all way younger than me. Some of them are young enough to be my grandkids, which is a terrifying thought.
What constitutes sort of asking a dumb question versus asking a reputable or respectable question?
Oh, I like that. Sometimes there's the dumb question that is the matter of fact one, you know, the one you're trying to get so that you get the coach or the player to say, yes, I'm so glad we won this game. It was a great win. Because sometimes you need that simple of a quote for a story sometimes, especially in a hurry on deadline, late games, whatever. And then there's the dumb question of, you know, you're stumbling through it. And I've asked that many a time. The best example of a truly dumb question might be, and I see it as a dumb question, where you haven't prepared. You haven't at least looked at some background. You know, if you get a player's name wrong, that may be the dumbest move of all. You have to do some preparation. Read through, you know, Google today makes it so easy, but, you know, flip through the game notes if you've got them from the organization, or at least, you know, check their stats, or do something so that when you do ask a question, you can, you know, you don't have to recite a paragraph of information when you're asking a question, but, you know, name, position. I've actually heard people, you know, get the position wrong, or ask somebody a question that has nothing to do with what they do. You know, those are, I would definitely put in the category of stupid questions.
The other day I had a kid from my alma mater call. He sent me an email and he said, I want to see if I could talk to you about becoming a sports writer. And I said, okay, sure. We talked the other day. We were talking for a few minutes and he said to me, so what do you do? And I thought, I would never fucking hire you for any job ever. Like, what do I do? Like, he literally was asking, what do I do for a living? Someone told him you should talk to this guy and he didn't take the 5 minutes to actually do the Google search.
I saw that and I was so astounded by that, because, you know, before I moved to AP, when I was at my first job, the Daily Times in Maryville, Tennessee, I was there for 2.5 years and I spent the last 9 months trying to get out of there. And I sent resumes to 75 newspapers from Michigan to Key West trying to get a job. And for each one of those, I called the newspaper and I got the name of the person and the title of who I should send a resume to so that I could spell it correctly, address it to the correct person, and make sure I had the mailing address right. Now I didn't hear back from many of those. The ones who back in the day actually sent rejection letters, I put them on my wall, but it wasn't because I didn't know who I was talking to.
Right. Wait, so you you did, like you said, you started the Maryville Times, small paper in Tennessee. So you spent the last 9 months trying to get out. Why?
Because when at the time I left, I was being paid $7.10 an hour. I was covering it, and it was one of those things, they didn't pay overtime. It was comp time, but the comp time was after the paper got put to bed. Then you could maybe take off for an afternoon. But then if you know, I covered the school boards. I covered some police beats, courts. Yes, every other Sunday, I'd go to the local jail and pull the accident reports and arrest reports for the weekend for a post on Monday morning. And, Yes, working 60 hours a week, being paid for 40 was not exact. And I did two sports stories the entire time I was there. So, and that was when one of the sports people would get mad at the pay or conditions and quit and leave. And they, you know, I filled in and covered one high school game and wrote one feature story, and that was it. And then I come to AP, and yes, I was 6 weeks away from trying to get a job on a cruise ship because I working in those conditions were very tough at the time.
Were you actually accepted for the job on the cruise ship, or was this just something you were applying to?
Applying to. I was giving myself till the month of December. AP, I got a call from AP in the middle of November and started December 4th, 1989. And when I walked into the AP Bureau, which in the day was between the Nashville Banner and Tennessean Newsrooms, I felt like I'd died and gone to heaven because I had wanted to work for the AP since I heard a professor in college talk about how much they paid coming out of college.
Do you remember what your first salary was at the AP?
I know that I doubled my salary from the Daily Times the first week I was there. So I think it was maybe $26,000-ish back in late 89. I could afford both a car and an apartment at the same time.
I started at 26 at the Tennessean, and that was 5 years after you you started the AP. So you were way ahead of me.
And that was the great thing. AP had slots, so you could top out at a certain point. But yeah, it was, you got credit for the experience you had somewhere else before you came to AP, which was really nice.
Back in the day when I started the Tennessean, there, it was a two newspaper town, and you had the Nashville Banner and you had the Nashville Tennessean, and they shared a building at 1100 Broadway, which you were based in as well. Was there a moment, maybe not a pinpoint moment, but a sort of time period when you started to see, crap, this business might be in trouble?
Probably when all the paywall talk started to come up, you know, we were trying to, you know, everyone's trying to get onto the internet, figuring out how to do it. And it's funny, music did it immediately. You're going to pay 99 cents or now what, $1.29 for a song. If you want a whole album, it's going to be this. And yet, you know, newspaper industry, it's like, well, we'll let them have this much. And oh, paywall. Well, we can't aggravate people. Well, you've been charging people for, you know, over a century for your paper, your product every single day. It's just a new way of how we do it. And that was the big sign. You know, I don't know why it's gotten so tough in journalism to want to make people pay for what we do. We take time. It takes energy. It takes money to drive to places to get reports and records and keep an eye on people. And, you know, shoot, for in sports alone, it costs money to fly riders to other cities to cover the team. You know, the Titans, you know, were in Kansas City. Well, the Tennessean had people there. They brought somebody from Knoxville. That actually costs money, you know, and they have to eat while they're there as well. So, you know, all this does cost money. It doesn't, you know, we're not little elves working in a tree, creating stuff and just needing, you know, nuts and berries to live on.
While you were saying that, I just thought about how absolutely insane it was that everyone was just giving away their product for free. Like someone thought, here's a great idea. Let's just give it away for free online. And that way no one will have to pay for it. Like, I don't even know what they were thinking.
Exactly. And these were the people who were supposed to be helping us walk into this stage of life, you know, in trying to transition. Now I say this, the Associated Press, our app is free. We do have some ads on it, but you know, we're kind of in a somewhat different situation. We're a nonprofit cooperative. It makes it easier. So, you know, if you want to follow me, just download the AP News app and go find Tennessee News. But, yes, I keep waiting for them to figure things out. As tough as newspaper places are with their websites, you also have the issue of, like the Athletic, you know, they tweet out a story, or I subscribe to the Tennessean. I'm a digital subscriber. And when they tweet out a story on Twitter, I try to click and read that story. And it's like, well, if you're a subscriber, I have to go somewhere else where I'm logged in. It's just, it's so complicated. And yet I can watch Amazon Prime on my phone, on my iPad, on the TVs. You know, there are ways to make these things talk and communicate more perfectly and smoothly. We just haven't gotten that into journalism yet.
The Tennessean has been its own worst enemy when it comes to digital. It is preposterous. I've experienced the same thing you do. Like, it should be the easiest thing in the world. You should make it as easy as opening up a newspaper and reading it. And they make you jump through five steps to see an article. It makes no sense whatsoever.
It is challenging. There's times where I've got the app, but I prefer to read it when in Safari on my iPad, and I go to click something, and I click, it click, doesn't move, and then suddenly it clicks, and I'm reading a story that I didn't click on. So there's times when that website and others can be a bit like playing whack-a-mole. Sometimes I'll get the story I'm trying to read.
I have a story in front of me that you wrote, and it was from July 4th, 2009. This is the headline in the Hattiesburg American. McNair's death ruled homicide, and you wrote, shot twice in the head and two more times in the chest. Former NFL quarterback Steve McNair was the victim of a homicide, police declared Sunday, but authorities wouldn't say it was a murder-suicide, even with his 20-year-old girlfriend dead at his feet from a single bullet. And you wrote this really sort of, you know, well-pieced together and kind of heartbreaking news story about Steve McNair's death. And I was wondering, as someone who had a lot of Titans experience, then covering the death of the most popular player, what was that like for you, I guess, professionally and emotionally?
That was tough. You know, we're professionals. You can set it aside to a certain extent. I was actually on vacation in Fort Walton, Florida on the day that it happened. And as soon as my mother-in-law comes down to the pool, says, hey, they're saying that they think McNair's dead in Nashville. And I go back up to the room. My phone had several hits on it. So I call and it's like, do we have this yet? So I make some calls. I confirm it. We get an alert out, and I'm working the story while we packed up our condo and drove through the night back to Nashville. Get home at 3:30. I'm in the office at 8 a.m. on that Sunday. And by 8:30, I've talked to Buzz Cook, his agent. I talked to the person who called the police a couple hours later and was working it for 70 hours or so over the next week. I covered the memorial service, went to Mississippi for the I drove down to Mount Olive where they had the viewing on, visitation or whatever they call it on that Friday night. And then the memorial service funeral on Saturday in Hattiesburg. So it was, you focus on the work, report the story at hand, but you're seeing people, who are in the Titans organization who, are processing, dealing with this grief, this situation. The memorial service was very challenging because, some of his teammates were talking to us before they went into the service, and we're monitoring it from a different part of this church. And we did have an opportunity to walk down by the casket. And, you just have to compartmentalize and you put those feelings away and then you deal with them later. And that was one of the most challenging weeks I've had as a professional in my career, probably outside of the week of 9/11.
What was McNair like to cover?
He was great. And these days they designate a couple players who will come to the banner, that are available once a week. Marcus Mariota, team quarterbacks, Derrick Henry speaks once a week, but McNair, he talked every day. You might have to wait an hour until he got done with treatment after a game or a practice, but you could talk to him, Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. You could talk to him with, it was never an issue. Now, his last year, we all kind of thought, and agreed he should, it's time. He could be a once a week kind of guy. And once after games, once a week during the week. So, but he was always available. And early in his career, he was not good. He didn't like it. He wasn't comfortable with it. But I give him huge credit. This is a guy who, on his off time, worked with Titans PR and folks. He got better. He became more comfortable and he became more talkative, and he became a really great person to talk with. Eddie George was always a great talker, one of those go-to guys, as we call him, in the locker room. But McNair worked at it, became really good, and it was easy to work with him. I did one story once on, he had back surgery in 99 and missed, like 5 weeks, and then came back. There was talk, should he start? Should it be Neil O'Donnell's team? And he had to do exercises after that to keep his back in shape. It wasn't like, oh, he's had surgery, he's perfect. And it was a fun conversation talking to him about everything that he did.
I'm going to ask you a question I've never asked anyone. How do you cover an asshole? I'm sure in your career, there have been people in locker rooms who are just assholes and they're not fun to deal with and they make your life difficult and you need them. So how do you cover an asshole?
That is a big challenge because they're everywhere. You just be professional. You go to them, you have your questions, and whatever type of asshole that they are, you have to be prepared to deal with that. I covered Pac-Man back in the day, And he got to a point where he simply wouldn't talk to us. But before he stopped talking to people, I was able to, you know, go to him because, you know, he did some incredible things on the field, had to write about them. So, you know, try to make sure you've got your questions, what you need to try to get, know those. And, you know, shoot, sometimes I'll practice them to make sure that if they're the kind of jerk that, you know, makes, you know, they try to get you off your game, make sure I have, you know, those keys. You know, you hear athletes talk about sticking to their keys. Well, we reporters have our own keys. I've had my questions, make sure I'm ready and go in, hit the points I need and try to pull out what I can use so I can still do my story.
I have known journalists who just decide I'm not talking to that person. Like I, there was a guy I knew who covered the Yankees way back in the day. Billy Martin was a manager. He's, I'm not talking to Billy. I will not talk to Billy Martin. And that seems like a bad way to go about it, just to refuse to talk to someone. But do you ever have to draw the line and just say, I'm Pac-Man Jones, I'm just not going up to him anymore. It's just not worth my time going up to him anymore.
I haven't gotten to that point. He was as close as possible to anybody. So when he got traded to the Dallas Cowboys, I think we all thought about having a party here in Nashville. Here's the thing. If an athlete is doing something that needs to be reported on, it's easy enough to go to other people to talk about him. But, you know, if you draw that line, then, you know, you're doing yourself a disservice because you still have to find a way to try to make it work. You know, if they're a complete flaming, total jerk, you know, then, you know, I can, especially in football, there's 52 other guys on the roster that I can go talk to. That makes it a lot easier. I haven't run into that. You know, I cover the Grizzlies. I have not run into that as an issue down there, because I wasn't down there much when Jason Williams was down there and grabbed Jeff Calkins' pen way once upon a time back in the day, in the locker room. But you talk to other people and, you know, I can't draw that line because if I do, then something's going to happen and I have to go talk to them. Why? Because they're an athlete. And if they do something, I cover the team. I've got to find a way to make that work. And if that person is a jerk to me and won't talk, then guess what? They run the risk of that being included in the story.
So I had a writer on maybe 2 months ago and she used to be the Baltimore Orioles beat writer. And she told me the story about an Orioles player calling her and say he had news he wanted to share with her. And she was very excited because she thought it was going to be a breaking a scoop. And she said, meet me in the hotel lobby. And then he said, well, come up to my room. I don't want anyone else to see. And she's thinking, wow, it's probably a really good scoop. And she gets up there and he has like candles and music playing and is trying to hit on her. And I asked her if she reported the guy and she said no. And she just viewed it as like, I can't win. I don't want that in my reputation, even though this guy really crossed the line. Do you feel like women reporters who are treated in ways like that by athletes should be speaking up and reporting it? Or do you feel like they still run a risk of their careers being damaged doing so?
Careers being damaged. I mean, that's the challenge. Even in this day and age of Me Too, I once dated somebody whose mother thought, why are women in the locker room? And it's like, well, it's because that's where we do our jobs. And there are still many people, sadly, who can't see women as simply doing our jobs. And that, no, I'm not interested in you in that way. I've been married to my husband and I've been married to my husband since before I got the Titans. So I don't know if the wedding ring helps. I'm probably not as young and cute that I'm getting hit on. I've never been hit on by an athlete. So I've been very lucky in that. You know, sometimes being a little overweight, a little older is a good thing. But for the younger women, I've talked to some. It's like I've been in practice where with the Titans, where some of young radio interns and, you know, some of the young players who are sitting out a drill or trying to talk to them. And I go to them and I tell them, you got to be careful and be, you know that there's a line. And if they cross it, you've got to make sure that they didn't, you know, it's such a tough line. If it happened to me, but I'm speaking at a point having over 30 years in the business, I would report because I would want that person to get a talking to before they get into worse trouble. But if you're 20 to 35, it's a much tougher situation. You know, it's when you've got that background, people know your reputation. Those are the kind of things that can help you if you were to make that argument and turn somebody in. So I completely understand the people who don't. Because again, you're unleashing I remember what happened to Lisa Olsen back in the day from what happened in the New England locker room. I had an editor try to talk me out of going into sports because of what happened to Lisa. She sent me story after story and was on the phone saying, don't do this. It's not going to be good for your career. And as much as I love that editor, I'm really glad I didn't listen. But again, everybody experiences it differently.
You had, I thought, a really fascinating story going on this year. Like one of the fascinating storylines in the NFL was the Titans benching Marcus Mariota for Ryan Tannehill. Do you feel like anyone was ever able to break through Marcus Mariota as he's sitting there on the bench, the former number two pick in the NFL draft, kind of watching his career slip away? Was anyone ever able, or were you ever able to break through and get how he was really, truly deep down feeling as all this was going on?
No, I don't think, and if somebody wrote something that I missed, I apologize, but I have not seen anything. And I talked to him a week ago, the Wednesday before the AFC Championship game. And, you know, it was a very short, not even barely two minute conversation, incredibly polite. And I'll say this. You know, Ryan Tannehill has praised him at the Pro Bowl for being just the ultimate teammate. And there's a snippet of video that was released from the AFC Championship game where Mariota was telling him, "I'm so excited for you. You know, this is just the first of many. You know, this is going to be great for you." He seems to be one of those rare birds that he is what you see. He is that nice and that genuinely good of a human being. And, but here's that challenge. He's a guy who has spoken to reporters at banners, you know, after games, during the practice week, mass situations. It's really tough these days to try to talk to, you know, if you want to talk to an athlete and try to cultivate a relationship that's away from the banner, you've got to go to their, some of their charity events, you know, try to do that. But when you go to a charity event, guess what? Their attention is elsewhere. So it's just become so much tougher to connect with these folks. But for Mariota, he absolutely, let's put it this way. I have a son who's almost 21. If my son were as good as Marcus Mariota, I would consider that I have, give me the gold trophy. I did it as a parent.
I'm going to date you. I want to ask you about a story you probably haven't thought about in 24 years. So I have a piece in front of me that you wrote, and the headline, I feel like I have you scared. The headline is Gilliam taking it one day at a time. And it was about Jill Gilliam, the former, Tennessee State quarterback, then Pittsburgh Steelers quarterback, who he's now deceased, but he was homeless at the time, and he was in Nashville. And your lead was, Joe Gilliam plans to watch his old team, the Pittsburgh Steelers, in the Super Bowl. Where he'll watch, Gilliam doesn't know. He doesn't know where he'll sleep that night either. Jefferson Street Joe, who won two Super Bowl rings with the Steelers in the 70s, is living on the streets of his hometown. He's been fighting drug addiction for over two decades. The fact that he will watch his Steelers try for the fifth championship is about the only sure thing Gilliam knows right now. And take it one day at a time, you know. A couple of days, that's too far down the line at this point, Gilliam said last week at a restaurant in his old neighborhood. He said he hasn't used heroin, a drug he began taking in late 1975, in over 5 years. Now he smokes some crack, but said only God can help him. First of all, I'm being serious. I always think of the AP as stilted, and I know you have, there are these confines, and, you know, you're expected, certain elements are expected. But your writing jumps out of that format. Like, it's just really good, consistently excellent. And not that you need to hear that from me. And
thank you.
This one's great. I mean, what do you remember about this story? Because he was a USFL quarterback. I wrote about him in my last book. What do you remember about that?
I remember sitting down at Sweat's restaurant at a big
Sweat's
table.
Oh, love Sweat's.
Yes. Yes. And unfortunately, I didn't take time to eat because we did it there. I can't remember the time of day, but they didn't have any customers in there. So I don't think they were quite open for business yet that day.
I just want to say, for people who don't know, Sweat's is a famous soul food in Nashville, not far from Tennessee State. Anyway,
awesome food. So,
yeah,
and he was as open as you could imagine. I mean, I was prepared for, you know, you go into a situation like that with what he was dealing with, prepared for, you know, combative, you know, secretive, you know, I didn't know what to expect. He was as open and honest about his struggles and his life as, you know, anyone I've talked to in my entire career. And he kind of helped write that story. It was more of a situation, listen to him and tell his story. So that made it, in a way, that was one of those that was just easy to write because he was so open and willing to talk about himself.
I love how he literally admits to you that he only smokes some crack. Like, that's unbelievable. I only smoke some crack. That's an unbelievable. You're not getting those quotes very often.
No. And when he said that, it's like, you know, sometimes when you're doing an interview, you hear a quote and it's like, you know, immediately that's my lead quote. That's my money quote. And then there's also, you know, that was one that's like, you think that and it's like, holy Toledo. He just said that, you know, and that tells you exactly where somebody is at when that, you know, they're only smoking some crack, you know, And sadly, after I wrote that story, I also made sure and wrote our preparedness for his obituary, because at that point, it just felt that, I had written about him before, because he had been trying to get his life right. But, at that point, you just knew that that was not going to have a good ending.
Yeah. He, when he played in the USFL, he was a quarterback for the Washington Federals, and he was living in a halfway house at the exact same time. He was a tragic, talented quarterback, not a dumb guy, but just couldn't get out of his own way.
And that's what addiction does to people. You know, it doesn't matter how incredibly talented an athlete you are, or musician, or artist, or just normal person. Addiction gets a hold of you, and it's a battle that too many people can't win.
He died a year after that story ran. So, let me say a final thing. You mentioned you cover different sports. Obviously, in Memphis right now, you have a rookie, John Morant, who's dazzling and breathtaking, and I don't even think he's 21 yet. Do you still get a charge of watching great athletes emerge, or after you've seen it a million times, is it just meh?
Oh, no. I got to watch Ja a year ago in Cookeville, a game at Tennessee Tech, for a story, because, we knew he was going to be a top pick in the draft. And that was nice. Got to meet his dad that night as well. And, so it never hurts when a player you've talked to before they get drafted in the pros ends up with one of your teams and you've talked to him before. But, watching Ja on a college court, I knew then this kid's going to be something at the NBA level. Watching him now with players who can catch his passes, who can keep up with him up and down the court, he's playing at an even better level than I anticipated. And no, I enjoy that. Watching Derrick Henry do what no one had done before over a 3-game stretch with over 180 yards, that was fun, because it's like, I hope if the day that I am too jaded to look at what somebody's doing, who's never been done before, or doing it at the top of their level, and if I'm too jaded to appreciate that, that's the day I need to quit.
The reason I left Sports Illustrated in large part was I just kind of got beaten up by sports, and I would find myself sitting in the outfield, especially after 9/11, I think sitting, in the press box or in the bleachers or wherever, thinking, ugh, another game. Like, what is there? There'll be another game next year, and there'll be another game after that. And meanwhile, whatever, the planet is melting and a million different things are going wrong. Do you never have your moments? Does sports still provide the charge for you that it always has?
It still provides the charge, but trust me, I completely get that monotony of feeling like the gerbil on a wheel. I just finished my 23rd year covering the Tennessee Titans, and it's like, the schedule will come out in April. Oh my God, there's going to be more games. I'm not ready for it. And climate change. I'm a political junkie, so I'm reading stuff every day, monitoring all the news of the day. And then I go back to sports, which AKA the toy department, there are many times where it feels like I could be covering something that people want to read about. But again, then I come back to this, that it's easier in sports to tell who's being paid to do what to whom. So I do like that simplicity at times of, there's these teams going out on a field and one's trying to win and the other's trying not to lose. And that helps keep me happy. And I truly do enjoy that.
Well, Teresa, I'm a huge fan, and I appreciate you doing this so much. So seriously, thank you for taking the time to talk to me.
My pleasure, Jeff. A pleasure.
I want to thank today's guest, Teresa M. Walker, for joining me on Two Writers, Sling and Yang. You can follow Teresa on Twitter at Teresa M. Walker and read her work in the Associated Press. One can listen to Two Writers, Sling and Yang on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and your views are always appreciated. Music is by the great MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me. And remember, keep writing.